Today is Wednesday, December 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Russia's government may be trying to stop its opposition leader's efforts to challenge Vladimir Putin in an upcoming election.
All the actions of Putin and his supporters show that Putin is really concerned about Navalny's popularity.
What the U.S. plans for strategy in the new year regarding North Korea, how U.S. immigration policies have changed under the Trump administration, and several Oscar contenders at the movies will get reviews. It's all on today's International Edition. A Kremlin spokesman suggested Tuesday that Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny's call to boycott next year's presidential election may be illegal. Navalny urged supporters to boycott the March 18th vote after election officials Monday barred him from running. Russia's Central Election Commission voted to ban the anti-corruption blogger from running because of his conviction on criminal charges. Navalny and his followers say those charges were politically motivated. He says without someone competing against Putin, the contest would not be free and fair. A spokesman for Putin, though, said Tuesday that efforts to organize the boycott ought to be carefully studied to see if they're breaking the law. It's widely assumed Putin will win a fourth term as the head of Russia. VOA's Steve Miller asks if it seems likely Navalny's calls to boycott the election are against the law in Russia.
You know, Russian law is such a tricky thing. So basically, the boycott of election is not a violation. But the law can be turned in different ways in Russia. It's basically not the nation of law as we used to have it in the United States. And so the thing is that every movement of opposition can be researched by the government and applied to the law they want to apply. So basically, yes, the Russian government can treat Navalny's action as something violating the law. Anyways, whatever they want to do, they will do.
And if we move outside of Russia, what are people saying about this online?
Former ambassador, in Russia, American ambassador, he said that if 80% of people support him, he means Putin, why wouldn't Putin want to crush Navalny in this election? So they kind of pointing that...
If there's an overwhelming support for Putin, why
not welcome a challenger? Why Putin is such afraid of Navalny? So all the actions of Putin and his supporters show that Putin kind of, you know, really concerned about Navalny's popularity in Russia and his ability to raise people to struggle and to resist. So maybe not win this election, but show a huge support in this election. If people see a huge support, they can, you know, start supporting him more. I think that's kind of thing that many speakers in Twitter want to show. Carl Bildt, for example, he writes the following. Not entirely surprising that Navalny is blocked from the Russian election in March. Genuine competition is seen as a threat.
Andrei Zarkoch is from our VOA Russian service. Thank you so much for stopping by the studio today.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. Defense Department is sued over flawed background checks of gun buyers. Eastern Libya will stage a conference in a march to rebuild Benghazi. Activists say Trump's fake news theme is being used to limit global press freedom. And a Ghana-born teen is the first African-American woman on U.S. Olympic speed skating team. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Less than a year into his presidency, Donald Trump has reshuffled the list of priorities on who among the country's refugees, undocumented immigrants, and immigrant hopefuls get to stay in the United States or enter in the first place. Few campaign promises have yet to come to fruition, and not without strong opposition and legal challenges. But for the many affected, 2017's decisions and reversals have led to a year of personal upheaval. Ramon Taylor reports.
In the last year, President Donald Trump has made ending the North Korean nuclear threat a national security priority.
And he's raised all kinds of expectations about what he is going to do about North Korea. And if he doesn't do those things, then it threatens his identity, it undermines him, it undercuts him.
In April, on the same day, President Trump dined with Chinese President Xi Jinping at his Florida Mar-a-Lago resort. He ordered a unilateral missile strike on Syria for allegedly using chemical weapons against civilians. Trump's demonstration of military force, his supporter said, sent a message to Xi that if China did not act to curtail North Korean provocations, the U.S. would. Vice President Mike Pence came to the region to reaffirm the U.S. commitment to its allies while downplaying threats made by Trump during the campaign to withdraw troops unless South Korea and Japan paid more defense-sharing costs. Trump found a strong supporter for his hardline North Korea policy in Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. However, South Korea, after the impeachment of conservative President Park Geun-hye, elected liberal Moon Jae-in, who supports strong deterrence but opposes the use of U.S. offensive military force on the Korean Peninsula.
President Moon has been quite clear that he believes that war on the Korean Peninsula should never be considered an option, unless the North Koreans start it first, of course.
While U.S. proponents of military intervention argued in favor of preventive war to eliminate the North Korean nuclear threat, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis cautioned that the casualties from such action would be tragic on an unbelievable scale. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on several occasions moved to support unconditional talks with leaders in Pyongyang, but Trump repeatedly rebuked his top diplomat, adding to speculation that the president may soon replace him. Trump instead has used inflammatory rhetoric, warning North Korea would face fire and fury, and calling Kim Jong-un a rocket man on a suicide mission. Pyongyang would back down from a threat to send an ICBM into waters near the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam, but launched two long-range missiles over Japan, and in September conducted its sixth nuclear test. At the United Nations, the U.S. and its allies convinced China and Russia to support stronger international sanctions that ban the North's lucrative coal and mineral exports and cut off one-third of its oil imports. In November, North Korea announced it had reached its goal of developing operational ICBM capability after conducting its most powerful missile test to date. Few expect any diplomatic breakthroughs anytime soon, but if North Korea agrees to participate in the upcoming Olympics in South Korea, there could be a pause in provocations. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Well, before heading out of Washington to celebrate Christmas, President Donald Trump capped the biggest legislative accomplishment of his first year in office Friday by signing a $1.5 trillion tax overhaul into law. The tax package is the most significant revenue bill since the 1980s here in the U.S., making a permanent cut to the corporate tax rate and reducing the tax burden for most individuals for at least a few years. But there are also some changes that could impact American families following a divorce and charities here and around the world. Joining us now to understand all of this is attorney Chris Melcher with Los Angeles-based law group Walzer Melcher. First of all, before we get to the other stuff, tell us who will benefit from these changes. All right, we'll get back to Chris at some point. We will now, where are we going? Coastal.
So the implementation of that is delayed until January 1, 2019. So for couples who have an alimony agreement or alimony order made on or after January 1, 2019, those orders will not be deductible by the payor of support, and the recipient of support will not have to claim that as income. So it's a radical change of how we've been doing things, where under existing law, whoever pays support gets a tax deduction for it, whoever gets the alimony has to pay income taxes on it. And so under that scheme, the IRS effectively subsidizes the support. For example, if somebody's paying $2,000 a month in alimony, they're getting a tax deduction for it. And so the after-tax cost of making that $2,000 a month payment is something less. Let's say it's $1,600 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the value of that deduction.
Mm-hmm.
And since it costs them less to pay the support, the theory goes they have a greater ability to pay support. And so our support calculators take into account that this payor is going to get the deduction and runs this iterative process to basically come up with more dollars to pay support, because we know this person is getting a tax break for the payment. In 2019, when that, at least for orders going forward, goes away, our support calculators are going to have to take out that tax break.
Mm.
And that means that the computer is going to spit out a lower number, and that person who had been paying $2,000 a month under current rules would probably end up paying $1,600 a month under the new rules. You know, so there's just going to be less money to go around for these families, and particularly for middle class people who are going through a divorce. That $400 a month payment, I mean, that's a car. Those are meals. Those are real, real important dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm worried that creates this additional hardship for divorcees.
And I know there are changes also to deductions for charitable giving that could certainly impact how much Americans donate to causes in the U.S. and even around the world, whether it be Elephants in Africa or Save the Children or Meals on Wheels. What can you tell us about that?
It's a little complicated. They're doing two things, two charitable deductions that could help or hurt. So right now, we can take an itemized deduction on tax return for charitable deduction, but it can't exceed 50% of our taxable income. Under the new rule, we take up to 60% of our taxable income as a charitable deduction. So in the one hand, we're actually going to be able to write off more of our charitable deductions next year than we can. The problem, though, is that they're raising the so-called standard deduction. They're doubling it next year. And so that gives people the option, the standard deduction versus itemized, to either take what's going to be $24,000 a year standard deduction for couples next year and just say, hey, I'm going to write that off my taxable income and I'm not going to bother itemizing things. So they have that choice. They can either take the standard deduction of $24,000 a year for a couple, or they can go through and itemize their deductions. The only point that somebody would itemize is if their deductions were more than $24,000, the standard deduction that they're getting. And so the concern is that people who are, say, giving $500 a year to charity or $1,000 a year in charity aren't going to have an incentive next year to take the itemized deduction for that $1,000 because their standard deduction just doubled. And so instead, they're going to find themselves not itemizing anymore, not needing the charitable deduction, and therefore just taking the standard one. And over time, that could hurt charities because their pitch about, like, hey, give us the money and you get a deduction for it, it doesn't carry as much weight. For big dollar givers, it may carry more weight because now that big dollar, somebody who's giving $100,000 a year in charity, let's say, can write off another 10% of it. And so whether that all balances out, is to be seen. So, at least on a facial look, the new plan does appear to support charities by raising it from 50 to 60%. But my guess is that due to raising that standard deduction, people aren't going to see the value in making these charitable deductions.
All right. Thanks so much for your perspective. That's attorney Chris Melcher with Los Angeles-based law group Walzer Melcher. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, coastal communities around the world depend on coral reefs for food, storm protection, and tourism, but many reefs are suffering under the onslaught of climate change. Scientists are fighting back, though. VOA's Steve Barragona visited labs in Florida where researchers are aiming to help reefs adapt to a hotter future.
Off the coast of Miami, divers are staking twigs of coral to the ocean bottom. These twigs were clipped from the University of Miami's coral nursery. Scientists working to restore degraded reefs recently discovered that corals grow faster when they're cut into smaller pieces, says project manager Dalton Hesley.
We can take a large boulder coral, fragment into a lot of small coin-sized pieces, increase their growth, and then fuse them back together to create a larger coral colony than we started with in a fraction of the time.
Branching corals like these work especially well. Hesley says the lab started 9 years ago with 30 finger-sized fragments.
We've turned those into over 3,500 in our coral nursery. So that means any day of the week we can collect hundreds of these staghorn and elkhorn corals to transplant onto local reefs as a natural way to promote growth and recovery.
The group has transplanted more than 11,000 corals so far. But those corals face the same warming oceans that are killing reefs in many parts of the world. Hesley's group does not want their efforts to go to waste. That's why they're working with their University of Miami colleague, Andrew Baker.
So that instead of planting out the next set of coral victims, we're actually planting out corals that we think are going to be more heat tolerant in the future.
Corals get their food and their bright colors from algae partners called symbionts. But when the water gets too warm, they lose the algae. These bleached corals cannot live for long. But, Baker adds,
it actually provides an opportunity for corals to potentially change their algal symbionts and become sort of colonized by new types of algae that are maybe more suited to the new environment.
Baker's lab is stressing out corals and selecting the ones that recover best.
Despite having been really severely bleached just a couple of months ago, they've actually recovered really well, and you can see that they've started to grow new branches.
The next step will be to plant stress-hardened corals on degraded reefs and see how they do. The team is optimistic that they can give the reefs a fighting chance, but they know there's only so much they can do.
We can't rebuild every reef around the globe, so that's why education is the second biggest part of our program and our efforts.
They recruit volunteers to help rebuild the reefs. They teach them about the need for global solutions to climate change, and they hope these citizen scientists will help spread the word. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Miami.
Well, less than a year into his presidency, Donald Trump has reshuffled the list of priorities on who among the country's refugees, undocumented immigrants and immigrant hopefuls, get to stay in the United States or enter in the first place. Few campaign promises have yet to come to fruition, and not without strong opposition and legal challenges. But for many affected, 2017's decisions and reversals have led to a year of personal upheaval. Ramon Taylor reports.
A year of promises.
We have to establish borders and we have to build a wall.
And threats to decades-old U.S. policy.
The RAISE Act prevents new migrants and new immigrants from collecting welfare.
Under the premise of securing the country's borders and boosting the economy, have come as a blessing to President Trump's base.
And anathema to millions more, among them undocumented millennial workers brought to the U.S. as children, beneficiaries of temporary protected status, refugees and travelers from several, mostly Muslim countries. In diversities like New York, many spoke out.
This is about Trump consolidating power through fear. It has nothing to do with making us safe.
They're just in fear of us, and they should not be, because we are stronger all together.
But the hope of establishing a future in the U.S. has become more uncertain. After a year of court battles, Trump's travel order is for now in effect for travelers from 8 countries, 6 of them majority Muslim. Separately, his government cut the total number of refugees by more than half in 2017, even fewer in 2018. The next big push is family-based or chain immigration. Recent terror incidents in New York have emboldened the White House. Would-be terrorist Akayedullah prematurely detonated a pipe bomb near Times Square after coming to the U.S. from Bangladesh on an F-4 or family preference immigrant visa.
The president's policy has called for an end to chain migration, and if that had been in place, that would have prevented this individual from coming to the United States.
Family-based immigration policy, in existence since 1965, would be replaced with a merit-based approach that would cut legal immigration in half.
Trump has also promised to get tough on illegal immigration, but the U.S. Immigration Agency removed some 14,000 fewer people than in 2016. Still, the number of immigration arrests increased, and immigration enforcement is staffing up.
Meanwhile, beneficiaries of temporary protected status from Haiti, Sudan, and Nicaragua are set to become illegal in coming months after their TPS benefits were ended. In September, Trump ended the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program for almost 800,000 young people brought to the country illegally as kids. Congress will have to decide their fate before March 2018. Many are terrified, while others have found a platform to push back.
For me, you know, as a lawyer, I'm going to defend my community in court, in the law, but also I'm going to defend my community here in the streets, and we're going to elevate our voices.
Sanctuary jurisdictions like New York have limited their cooperation with federal immigration authorities because they say they need their resources to fight local crime and not tear communities apart. But the Trump administration has pushed back on that logic.
There's this falsehood that's being pushed out there that sanctuary cities protect immigrant communities. No, they put immigrant communities at risk of more arrests because they're forcing their hand to go into neighborhoods.
In November, a judge blocked threats to strip federal funding from sanctuary jurisdictions, calling them a violation of the Constitution. But as with the travel ban, the court fight isn't over.
And Trump's signature promise to build a big, beautiful wall along 1,600 kilometers on the southern border has been reduced to a down payment of 119 kilometers in 2018. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
Well, Americans are celebrating the holidays with time off from work, and many are flocking to movie theaters. Lots of good choices this season, and joining us now for reviews of a few of them is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hi, Jeff. So let's start with the crime thriller about All the Money in the World. Is that what it's called? What's that about, and what do you think?
It's interesting. Not only is it a fascinating, based on a true story about the kidnapping of the world's richest man, his grandson, for ransom, but also behind the scenes on the actual making of the movie is just as interesting. And it comes from director Ridley Scott, one of our greatest directors, and it stars Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg as a couple trying to find the grandson of John Paul Getty after being kidnapped by Italian terrorists. They want $17 million, and the story, it's the historical facts, is they end up cutting his ear off, the grandson's ear, and sending it demanding money for his safety. And so Mark Wahlberg plays Getty's, like, second hand, like his fixer. So he's on top of it with Michelle Williams, who plays the grandson's mother, and it's just fascinating to see how the super rich live. Even in the 70s, nothing changes when you're the world's richest family. And so it's not only how they handle things, but also just the attitudes of all the people involved. And what's also fascinating is behind the scenes with this movie, it was Kevin Spacey who played Getty Sr. And Ridley Scott made the decision to reshoot all of his scenes with Christopher Plummer, who he wanted originally for the film. And so they only had maybe a month to do reshoots, $10 million, and they end up giving us an incredible drama that's definitely going to be probably remembered around Oscar time.
Fascinating. You know, it's hard to choose. There are so many good movies out right now. Molly's Game, I haven't really heard much about it other than it's starring Jessica Chastain and it's a drama suspense thriller.
It is. It's another one based on true events, on true story about, about Molly. She was an Olympic skier hopeful, and she was injured. So she was trying to figure out early in her life what she was going to do career-wise. So she's got involved, listen to this, underground poker games for the rich and famous. So So not only movie stars and politicians and movers and shakers, but she ended up attracting the attention of the Russian mob. So not only did she have games going on in Los Angeles and New York, but then she was making all of this money by holding these illegal poker games, and the FBI got wind of it too. So it's just a real fascinating story about how a woman who didn't know anything about poker, didn't know anything about gambling, stumbled into that as like a hostess for these underground games before she took them over herself and made a lot of money. And also it's fascinating, it's come from Aaron Sorkin, you know, from West Wing, and he's just one of the world's greatest screenwriters. And this is his directorial debut. And Jessica Chastain is just phenomenal as Molly. And her attorney is played by Idris Elba also. So the movie, just the dialogue is intense. It moves quickly. It's just really a fascinating film to watch.
And there's a fun one, or I could be presuming it's fun. It may not be upbeat, but I would think it is. The musical, the P.T. Barnum movie, Greatest Showman.
Yeah, we have something for the family, a movie musical like they made in the old days. And when I mean that, I mean, this is a big, lavish, colorful dance movie that just the kids will go crazy for it, and so will the adults. And, you know, Hugh Jackman, people know him as Wolverine and as a dramatic actor, but this man was on Broadway doing Oklahoma. He was on The Boy from Oz. This guy can sing and dance. And this is one of his personal projects he's been working on for the last 10 years to bring to the big screen. The stage to the screen, you have the songwriters from La La Land, and it's about the life of P.T. Barnum, one of the first showmen to really kind of use social media of the day, you know, the newspapers, to show the smallest man in the world, the tallest man, the bearded lady, all those famous sideshow, essentially freaks, as they called him back then. But the movie does more than that in terms of being a lavish musical. It also teaches about our differences and our strengths and how diversity is a good thing. So it's got a lot of positive messages, but also just amazing dance numbers and sequences. And just watching Hugh Jackman, he's just a treasure. He really is. The family will love it.
Jeffrey K. Howard, his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Thanks for joining us on International Edition. Thanks to director Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For the flood of migrants and refugees escaping the violence and poverty of several African countries and heading toward Europe for the opportunity of a better life, the most common route out of North Africa is through Libya. They present targets for people and criminal groups who prey on migrants. Their brutality knows no bound: sexual exploitation, forced labor, the removal of bodily organs, and slavery are the tools of their trade, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The migrant crisis in Libya received international attention once again following the recent report by CNN on African migrants being sold as slaves in unidentified locations across the country. Migrants were reportedly sold for as little as $200. Migrants who are smuggled can be extremely vulnerable to human trafficking, abuse, and other crimes, as they are illegally present in the country of destination or country of transit, and often owe large debts to their smugglers. Some smuggled persons may be subjected to sex or labor trafficking while in transit or at their destination. The Libyan Government of National Accord, the GNA, launched an investigation into the allegations of trafficking in persons and pledged to hold perpetrators accountable. The United States strongly supports these efforts, and we view the GNA as a vital partner in combating human trafficking. The United States also continues to contribute to assistance programs that support the humanitarian needs of refugees, migrants, and individuals in detention in Libya. The United States works to combat human trafficking by focusing our efforts on the 3P paradigm of prosecution, protection, and prevention. We are funding research into the connection between conflict and vulnerability to human trafficking to help us understand how to better prevent this crime from happening in the first place. We hope to protect victims by immediately identifying them in conflict situations and assisting them, and we hold traffickers accountable by prosecuting them. We believe a victim-centered approach to investigation and prosecution of human trafficking is critical to overall success of law enforcement efforts. This includes commitments by states not to prosecute trafficking victims for acts committed as a direct result of being subjected to human trafficking, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Nikki Haley. We will continue to work with the UN Security Council and with partner governments to end this barbaric assault on human dignity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.